From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A Supreme Court divided. Today, the nation's highest court will decide the fate of the next presidency. But should Justice Scalia recuse himself from the vote? The man who would like to be the next Chief Justice has said, according to his friends, that if Gore won the presidency, he would quit the Supreme Court. Also, a look at the debate between the FBI and supporters of Native American activist Leonard Peltier. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Lawyers for Republican George W. Bush and Democrat Al Gore are arguing in the U.S. Supreme Court today in a showdown that could finally decide who will be the 43rd president of the United States. At issue is a Florida Supreme Court ruling on Friday, which ordered the immediate hand recount of tens of thousands of ballots in Florida. But the U.S. Supreme Court, splitting by a 5-vote along conservative and liberal lines on Saturday, halted the recounts until it hears oral arguments and then decides Bush's appeal. A ruling could come at any time after the arguments. UN officials announced yesterday that 122 countries have agreed on a treaty banning 12 highly toxic chemicals. PCBs, dioxins, and other chemicals on the Dirty Dozen list are known as persistent organic pollutants. They break down slowly, travel easily in the environment, and have been linked to cancer, birth defects, and other genetic abnormalities. Production and use of 9 of the 12 chemicals will be banned as soon as the treaty takes effect, likely 4 to 5 years after the signing ceremony this May. South Korea and the United States have failed to reach agreement in the latest round of talks aimed at revising a controversial military treaty governing some 37,000 U.S. troops stationed in Korea. The talks to alter the treaty have been off and on since 1996. Though officials wouldn't elaborate, local reports reveal that the main areas of disagreement are Seoul's demands for greater jurisdiction over U.S. criminal suspects and for including a provision on environmental regulations. The call for environmental regulations came after U.S. military authorities acknowledged dumping toxic material earlier this year into the Han River, the major source of drinking water for Seoul's 11 million people. A U.S.-led commission began investigating 10 weeks of Middle East bloodshed today, starting talks with Israeli and Palestinian leaders on a visit overshadowed by political turmoil. The 5-member international team, led by former U.S. Senator George Mitchell, met Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak in Jerusalem and was due to meet Palestinian President Yasser Arafat in the Gaza Strip later in the day. Yesterday, right-winger Benjamin Netanyahu turned Israel's political establishment on its head, announcing he intends to challenge Barak, the Labor Party prime minister, in an election that will set the course of Middle East peacemaking. Although he's the front-runner in opinion polls, Netanyahu is barred from standing because of a law that allows only members of parliament to contest a special election for prime minister, which Barak forced by resigning on Sunday. Netanyahu gave up his parliamentary seat and leadership of the right-wing Likud after his election loss to Barak last year, and his allies are struggling to find a way for him to run. No date was set for the ballot, but it was widely expected to take place on February 6th. Ion Iliescu won a landslide victory for a third term as Romania's president, as voters rejected a radical nationalist whose denunciation of Jews, gypsies, and minorities would have threatened hopes for European integration. Official results from Sunday's balloting showed Iliescu winning more than 66% of the vote. Iliescu is a former communist who led the 1989 uprising that toppled dictator Nicolae Ceausescu, calling his victory a rebirth of hope and promised to accelerate reforms aimed at winning membership in NATO and the European Union. This news from El Salvador. 19 years after one of the worst massacres in El Salvador, hundreds of villagers buried 37 of their loved ones in a humble ceremony and said their final goodbye. The remains buried yesterday are among 200 recovered so far in the municipality of Miangera, where local residents and human rights groups believe more than 1,000 villagers were gunned down by U.S.-trained Salvadoran soldiers in December of 1981 in what has come to be known as the Humalzote Massacre. The peasants were believed to be sympathizers of the rebel army. Argentinian experts started digging up the graves in 1992, but stopped for 7 years after funds ran out. They resumed their work in April at the request of family members who wanted to give their loved ones a Christian burial. Church officials are searching for funds to continue the digging in the future. During a midnight mass on Saturday, more than 500 poor farmers and their families prayed in front of the 24 coffins placed on a platform outside the small church in the town, 125 miles northeast of San Salvador. 22 of the dead were children, some of whom shared the same coffin. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. For most of the show today, we're going to have a debate on the case of Leonard Peltier, the Native American activist who has been in prison for close to a quarter of a century. We'll be joined by his lawyers as well as agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. But first, this news about the presidential election and response to it. Lawyers for George Bush and Al Gore preparing for a historic U.S. Supreme Court showdown today that could finally decide who will be the 43rd president of the United States. After 5 weeks of legal battles, one of the closest presidential elections in history could turn on the 9 votes of the highest court in the land, whose justices appear to be as deeply split on the issue as the rest of the country. In a bitterly divided division of 5-4 over the weekend, the court reversed a Florida Supreme Court order and halted a manual recount of ballots. The recount had been underway and had cut Bush's lead to less than 200 votes. Both Bush and Gore need Florida's 25 electoral votes to put them over the 270 mark to win the presidency. The deadline for selecting the electors is tomorrow, December 12th, and the Electoral College meets on December 18th to select the president. Leading the effort to stop the hand recounts are two justices, Antonin Scalia and William Rehnquist. Today, we're going to start off by looking at Antonin Scalia. There's a very interesting piece in the New York Daily News headlined, "Justice Scalia's Legal Vision is Blinded by His Ambition." It's a piece by Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Jim Dwyer. He starts off by saying earlier this year, Antonin Scalia, the Supreme Court justice who now is all but serving as the attorney for George W. Bush, let it be known that if Democrats won the presidency, he'd quit the court. He would leave because under a Democratic administration, he would have no shot at being named Chief Justice by Al Gore, according to the March issue of The Washingtonian magazine. We've just caught up with Jim Dwyer in a taxi cab. Explain this column.
Justice Scalia has played a central role in both of the arguments that have come before the court concerning the 2000 election. And on Saturday, he said that there would be irreparable harm to George W. Bush if the counts were allowed to go forward and somehow placed a cloud over the results of the election that Bush has claimed to have won. Now, some conservative legal scholars say, well, normally you balance the harms between the two parties, in this case, Al Gore, and then you decide who's got the greater harm. Scalia didn't actually make any balance on the question of, or attempt any balance on the question of whether Al Gore might be harmed by stopping the recounts, but a number of scholars believe that he would be harmed far greater than George W. Bush. In any event, Justice Scalia also said, essentially, that we should not know the facts about this because they could prove damaging to a Bush presidency or place a cloud on it. Now, there's a couple of interesting things about Justice Scalia, one of which is that in March, an article appeared, a small item appeared in the Washingtonian magazine, attributed to friends of his who said that if he were to be in a situation this fall when the Democrats had taken the presidency, he would leave the court. And the reason was that he was tired of being on the fringes of the court. He wanted to be the Chief Justice, and he knew that would not take place under a Democratic presidency. So if the Republicans were there, he had hopes of becoming the Chief Justice. Now, if you could imagine a situation in which a justice takes a public position that he would like to be the chief legal officer of Texaco, for instance, and Texaco came before the Supreme Court with an employment dispute between two people who were arguing that each of them had the right to be the chief executive officer of Texaco, and the judge knew that one of those guys was going to make him the chief legal officer and the other one wasn't, that judge couldn't hear that case. It just is a fundamental matter of legal ethics and procedure.
Because the president is the one who nominates the Chief Justice.
The president is the one who nominates the Chief Justice. Now, he has to be approved by the Congress, by the Senate. And obviously that would not happen under Al Gore. On the other hand, George W. Bush has said that if he were president, he'd look for people in the mold of Scalia and the other conservative member of the court, Clarence Thomas. So it's pretty clear that Justice Scalia, if these remarks that are attributed to him in the Washingtonian magazine, or if this viewpoint and this ambition are truly his, then all the precedents and all the code of ethics make it clear that he cannot sit on this case and decide it.
You also have his son serving in the law firm that's representing George Bush.
That's right. Although I believe they have made a consultation with legal ethicists on that particular issue, and everybody agrees apparently that it's okay for them to go forward because the son is not involved in any way in the case. But there's no question that his own personal ambitions, if they are truly stated, are relevant and have not yet been aired, as far as I know, by any, sort of competent body to consult on this.
Also on the issue of Antonin Scalia, you write that he could not have been bolder in his advocacy for Bush's cause and by extension his own. During oral arguments 2 weeks ago, he took shots at the Florida courts, which had said the most fundamental right in a democracy is the vote. He disagreed.
That's right. He pointed out that there is no right of suffrage in the Article 2 of the Constitution, which sets out the method of selection of the president. It says that this is in the hands of the state legislature. That is literally true, but it is also literally true that every single one of the state legislatures has procedures in place so that the election of the president is done by direct vote, at least insofar as each state's electors are concerned. So it's a little bit disingenuous, a little bit radical. I mean, I actually think that if Scalia were a left-wing person, he would not be a Marxist, he'd be a Stalinist. He's so far off the charts. One of the interesting things that people don't know about Scalia, I think, is that he's frequently so far to the right that the other conservatives on the court take cover when he issues one of his opinions in the famous Herrera versus Collins decision concerning the claims of innocence by a man who was about to be executed in Texas. Judge Scalia said that there is nothing in the Constitution, nothing in statute, nothing in the law that says it is unconstitutional to execute an innocent person as long as they've had a fair trial. The other justices could not, you know, traffic with that opinion, aside from Clarence Thomas, who frequently, almost always actually, sides with Justice Scalia.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Jim Dwyer, even if you are in a taxi.
Okay, thanks a lot, Amy.
Jim Dwyer, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist with the New York Daily News, talking about Justice Scalia's legal vision. Is it blinded by his ambition? It's a column in the Daily News today. And speaking of politics, the men who will be arguing before the Supreme Court, Theodore Olson, George W. Bush's chief lawyer, former assistant attorney general in the Reagan administration and partner in the Washington law firm Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher. Olson has also argued more than a dozen cases before the high court. He's a close friend and ex-law partner of former independent counsel Kenneth Starr and represented David Hale, a witness in the Whitewater land deal investigation headed by Starr. Olson also represented the Virginia Military Institute in its attempt to remain all male and represented four white students in Texas in a case that led to the end of affirmative action at the University of Texas Law School. David Boies is Al Gore's chief lawyer, known for his courtroom charm and wearing black sneakers into the courtroom. Boies won the government's antitrust case against Microsoft. He most recently represented the music swapping firm Napster in its fight to stay in business. Boies also has been retained by cigarette maker Philip Morris to help defend it against a $69 billion lawsuit by tobacco growers in 14 states. And Joseph Klock will be speaking, lawyer for Florida Secretary of State Katherine Harris, a Republican, and other members of the State Elections Board. We're joined right now on the telephone by Jamin Raskin. He is a constitutional lawyer, professor at American University Law School. Welcome to Democracy Now! Again, Professor Raskin.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
Well, the significance of today's arguments and what this means. I mean, you just heard Jim Dwyer laying out Antonin Scalia saying he should recuse himself, considering he would be dependent on the next president to be named Chief Justice.
Well, I don't know about that, because after all, any of these justices could theoretically be appointed Chief Justice.
But he said he would quit, according to his friends.
Right. Well, I think Rehnquist has said that he would leave the court only if a Republican were elected and would not leave the court if a Democrat were elected. And since he wants to retire, he also would be invested in that. Look, I think several of them have made their intentions clear about leaving the court. A number of the Republicans have said they would leave or have confided to people they would leave if a Republican were elected, and some of them want to go off and make some money with kids in college and stuff. But I don't think we would really want to create a standard of recusal in cases like that. I mean, the real issue here is that there is no legal substance or predicate for what's about to take place, which is the five conservatives on the court intervening, overruling a state Supreme Court's interpretation of state law, which is a perfectly sound and reasonable interpretation of state law, in a very politically motivated effort to deny the presidency to Bill Clinton. And I think, perhaps unlike some other people, that the cake is pretty much baked already. In entering the stay over the weekend, the five justices committed themselves to a position that there is a probable likelihood of success on the merits by Bush, and that he faced irreparable harm, which is why they entered the extraordinary order stopping the counting of ballots. And unless somehow Justice O'Connor can be turned by David Boies today in court, it's hard for me to see exactly where the fifth vote comes from to renew the process of hand-counting the ballots.
They say it all comes down to Kennedy or O'Connor.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, you know, Rehnquist, Thomas, and Scalia are a completely lost cause. I'm afraid that Kennedy probably also should be counted in that camp. O'Connor herself was a Republican partisan, you know, Arizona Republican politician, president of the state legislature, and so on. Very tough. Now, on the other hand, what the Democrats have going for them is that what the Republicans, the hardcore conservatives on the court are determined to do here cuts against every jurisprudential bone in their body. That is, it's a violation of federalism. It's an assault on the integrity of a state judiciary and a state legal process. And it's one of the most extraordinary acts of judicial activism in our history. But all of this just goes to show that politics comes before law rather than law before politics.
What about George Bush using the 14th Amendment of the Constitution?
Well, there are, of course, multiple ironies here. I mean, this is a court that has repeatedly used the Equal Protection Clause in a way that would have appalled the designers of equal protection. Equal protection now works primarily for white people rather than for racial minorities. This court, since 1993, in its decision in Shaw versus Reno, has been on a campaign to dismantle majority African-American and majority Hispanic congressional districts and state legislative districts when they have a so-called bizarre appearance on the map. The court, we know, has used equal protection to strike down affirmative action plans, as in the Hopwood case at the University of Texas, where David Boies was a lawyer for the white students challenging affirmative action. Equal protection now in the hands of this five-person majority primarily works against the interests of racial minorities and for white people and for white voters specifically. This is a court that has not hesitated to intervene to overturn the handiwork of state legislatures when they think somehow it offends the right of white voters to be in a political majority in the states. Now, this court rejected an equal protection attack several months ago on Congress's disenfranchisement of hundreds of thousands of American citizens who live in Washington, D.C., a lawsuit brought by the D.C. Corporation Council, backed by the mayor of Washington, the D.C. Council, and the vast majority of people who live in the city, was brought before the court. It failed 2-1, but had a resounding opinion in its favor by Judge Louis Obadorfer, the senior judge on the district court panel, and the Supreme Court refused even to hear oral arguments in the case, with only Justice Stevens dissenting from that decision to deny oral arguments. So this is a court which is not friendly to voting rights. It's not friendly to the principle of universal suffrage, and the five-person conservative majority has not hesitated at every possible turn to overturn state laws in order to further a conservative agenda.
Jamie Raskin, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of constitutional law at American University. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, a debate on the case of Leonard Peltier as President Clinton weighs whether to grant the Native American leader executive clemency. We'll be back. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Around 2,000 protesters rallied yesterday across the street from the United Nations in New York City on International Human Rights Day, calling on President Clinton to grant executive clemency to Leonard Peltier. The Native American activist has been in prison for almost a quarter of a century after being convicted of killing two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation in North Dakota. he has always maintained his innocence. Among those who rallied were some of his grandchildren, as well as dozens of people who flew in from the Pine Ridge Reservation. Also speaking on his behalf were his lawyers and writer Alice Walker. In an interview that President Clinton did on WBAI Pacifica Station last month, and the first time he addressed the issue publicly, President Clinton said he is weighing executive clemency for Leonard Peltier. President Clinton, since it's rare to get you on the phone, let me ask you another question. That is, what is your position on granting Leonard Peltier, the Native American activist, executive clemency?
Well, I don't have a position I can announce yet. I believe there is a new application for him in there, and when I have time after the election's over, I'm going to review all the remaining executive clemency applications and see what the merits dictate. I will try to do what I think the right thing to do is based on the evidence. And I've never had the time actually to sit down myself and review that case. I know it's very important to a lot of people, maybe on both sides of the issue, and I think I owe it to them to give it an honest look-see. So part of my responsibilities in the last 10 weeks of office after the election will be to review the requests for pardons and executive clemencies and give them a fair hearing, and I pledge to do that.
And you will give an answer in his case?
Oh, yeah. I'll decide one way or the other.
And finally, do you support a more... President Clinton on Election Day on WBAI Pacifica Radio. Well, the FBI is planning to hold a rally this Friday in front of the White House opposing clemency for Peltier. Today, a debate between lawyers for Leonard Peltier, Jennifer Harbury, and Bruce Ellison, and two FBI agents, James Burris, Assistant Special Agent in charge of the FBI's Minneapolis Division, and John Sennett, President of the FBI Agents Association. John Sennett, let's begin with you. Why are you opposing clemency for Leonard Peltier?
Well, a couple of points that I'd like to clarify right at the start is that the FBI is not holding a rally on Friday of this week. The FBI, as a governmental agency, doesn't hold rallies. It'll be a gathering of FBI employees who are using vacation time, taking some of their vacation time to rally on their own initiative.
Right. The reason I said it that way is because when we called the FBI for you to come on, for different FBI agents to come on, they were the ones who faxed us the press release about the rally.
They're sharing information, of course, but I just wanted to, in case some of your listeners were under the impression that this was an official action of a government agency, I wanted to clarify that point. And another point that I want to clarify is that we are directing our gathering at the president, of course, because the decision to give clemency or not is his alone. But we're not presuming that the president is inclined to do that at this point in time. We're simply trying to counter, as best we can, what we regard as an ill-founded and long-standing effort on the part of Leonard Peltier's supporters to encourage the president to grant clemency. So we're trying to be a counterbalance to what we think is an incorrect advocacy of Leonard Peltier.
Right. Now, Janet Reno, the Attorney General, rebuked Louis Free for issuing the statement opposing executive clemency for Leonard Peltier. But let me ask James Burris, your office prosecuted Leonard Peltier, the FBI's Minneapolis Division. What are the main arguments against him? What did you think were the most powerful points proving his guilt in the killing of the two FBI agents?
Well, first of all, the FBI, of course, we do the investigations. The U.S. Attorney's Office does the prosecution. But the facts of Leonard Peltier's case and the way that we decide guilt or innocence in the United States of America is through the jury system. We have an opportunity to put on our witnesses and our forensic evidence and the case that we make. We have a duty beyond a reasonable doubt to prove this along with our partners in the U.S. Attorney's Office. The defense, likewise, has an opportunity to examine witnesses, to give facts of their own, to give alternative versions, and to present their case as they see fit. In our position has always been that the jury has come to the right decision, and that every appeals court that has ever heard this has never given his side or the defense side an ounce of believability. Clearly, Mr. Peltier had the opportunity 25 years ago when he was walking across a field in South Dakota, 200 yards. It wasn't that he shot the agents in a shootout. He clearly, the agents were alive. The wounds were non-fatal. Mr. Peltier and his friends could have left the area at that point, and the agents would still be alive today to enjoy their grandkids and their kids. Mr. Peltier crossed 200 yards of prairie to execute these two men along with his buddies in cold blood. I mean, there's just no question about that. The compelling case that, to me, are the shell casings that entered the trunk of the car that matched Mr. Peltier's weapons, no matter what the defense said. I mean, there's no question about that. Every court of appeal that's ever looked at that has determined that that's the case. Mr. Peltier's flight clearly is an issue. Mr. Peltier's a violent man. He has a violent background. He shot it out with an Oregon trooper when he was confronted in Oregon after shooting the agents. He escaped from prison after he was already in prison. I mean, all these things add up. There's so many different things that point to his guilt that it would take me the entire 60 minutes to simply go through them all.
We're also joined by Jennifer Harbury, one of the attorneys for Leonard Peltier. In a nutshell, can you summarize the case and the circumstances around it?
I'd be happy to. I think the first thing we want to say is that, of course, no one's suggesting that the shooting, whether intentional or accidental, of any human being is something that we would, you know, say is a good thing. But for any person to be put in prison in this country, they have to be tried by a court with a full and fair hearing and with untainted and unfabricated evidence. What we feel went wrong in the trial of Leonard Peltier are the following basic points. Number one, he was extradited from Canada. He had fled to Canada not because he believed he was guilty, but because
I want to go back even before that. Mm-hmm. Explain what happened on the day that the two FBI agents were killed.
Okay. This was the period called the Reign of Terror on Pine Ridge Reservation. It began right after the occupation of Wounded Knee, where traditionalists, Lakota traditionalists, men, women, children, and elders had occupied the town to protest abuses by the government, and the U.S. military had responded with literally military force, firing hundreds of thousands of rounds against the people inside. The era then began when the White House promised investigations. People returned to their homes. Instead, the FBI appeared in massive numbers instead of the promised investigations. And the local vigilante group, which worked very closely with the FBI, it's literally called the Goon Squad, Guardians of the Oglala Nation, then began a reign of repression against all of the AIM supporters and sympathizers and traditionalists on the reservation.
AIM being the American Indian Movement.
Houses were burned, cars were run off the road, and 64 AIM supporters and members were literally murdered with virtually no repercussions by the FBI or any other enforcement agency. In the midst of this reign of terror, the Jumping Bull elders became very frightened for their own safety and asked an AIM contingent to camp out on their ranch. And Leonard Peltier was sent there with a very small group of people, most of them in their teens. I think the average age was 15 or 16. An 11-year-old was also present. On June the 26th, 75, in the midst of this reign of terror, two FBI agents in an unmarked car in plain clothes chased a red pickup truck onto the ranch, and a shootout began between the two vehicles. Literally, children were caught in the crossfire. Everybody thought that the goon squads had come to kill them, which was very reasonable under those conditions. Everybody began to scream, "Help, help, we're under attack, we're under assault," and everybody returned fire. At the end of the shootout, the two agents were indeed dead, as was a young Native man named Joseph Stuntz, who has never been, that death has never been investigated in any way or considered to be a murder, although he was also shot through the head by a sniper fire. At that point, the entire ranch was encircled. The red pickup truck was able to jump the police lines and escape shortly after the shooting and was never identified or intercepted. And the vigilante groups and the FBI and SWAT patrol cars and militias encircled the ranch and poured gunfire down on all of the remaining AIM people inside, again, most of whom were minors. The government was once again shooting at children. Leonard saved all of their lives by leading them through an underground pipeline, out literally under the SWAT patrol cars, out the other side through a hail of bullets to safety with other Native people on the ranch, outrage shooting into the air and throughout the reservation to distract the FBI so that the children would not be killed. Leonard then fled to Canada, believing he would never receive a fair trial. His two friends, the other adult AIM leaders on the ranch that day, were immediately arrested and put on trial for the murder of the two agents. They were acquitted. The jury found there was no evidence that they fired the point-blank bullets that did kill the two agents. And they were also, the jury also ruled that simply returning fire under those conditions was a matter of self-defense. Then we come to Leonard's trial. As I say, he had fled to Canada because he believed he could not receive a fair trial. That was well grounded. The FBI was being severely rebuked by many judges in that region in that era for coercing witnesses and otherwise tampering with prosecutions against AIM members in that region. In the Wounded Knee siege prosecution, for example, the charges were thrown out of the court altogether, with the judge literally shouting, "The waters of justice have been polluted. These charges are dismissed." Leonard was brought back from Canada in chains after a local woman named Myrtle Pourbaix signed an affidavit saying, "I'm his girlfriend. He did those executions right in front of me." She then went to the judge and said, "I've never met Mr. Peltier. I wasn't even on the ranch. I signed after the FBI terrorized me for days and said they would take my children away if I didn't." She was not allowed to tell the jury about this. The jury, unlike all the other juries in similar prosecutions against AIM leaders then, were not allowed to hear about the other cases where the FBI had been rebuked for tampering with the evidence and tampering with witnesses. So they could not properly evaluate the three 15-year-olds who were dragged in by the FBI. And who had literally been tied to chairs, denied the right to talk to their attorney, and very, very terrorized, and who later admitted their entire testimonies had been really heavily influenced by the terror and coercion they had received. The worst part is that the ballistic test issue, the ballistics expert for the FBI said that this is Mr. Peltier's gun, this is the bullet casing we found near the bodies, and we could not do the best test because this gun was damaged in a fire, so we did a much less good test, and it shows that the casing and gun match. Years later, in the Freedom of Information Act, they were able to find that expert's own records. He had done the better ballistics test. He could do it. He did do it. And he put in his own report, this bullet casing does not come from that gun. It's a different firing pin test. That evidence had been withheld from the jury. The prosecution also said again and again there was no other rifle except Peltier's that could have inflicted that injury. They now admit there were many. Lastly, their own radio intercepts had always said that the two FBI agents were chasing a red pickup truck. Again, after the trial, it became very, very clear that it had always been a red pickup truck. The FBI director had said the day after the shootout they would find that red pickup truck. They stopped red pickup trucks for anywhere near the reservation for weeks trying to locate it. At Leonard's trial, they had a problem. Leonard didn't drive a red pickup truck, so they changed that to be an orange and white van that Leonard was sometimes seen driving and claimed that the FBI had chased Leonard onto the ranch and that he was the one who had started the shootout. With all of these errors, one would think he would have gotten a new trial, and they did, in fact, demand a new trial, at which the U.S. attorneys began to sheepishly admit that, in fact, no one knows who fired those fatal shots. Leonard's basically in the same posture as his two friends who were acquitted 25 years ago. No one knows who fired those two shots, those two fatal shots, but Leonard did not get a new trial because of a legal technicality. The judges even wrote in their opinion that but for that FBI conduct, the jury might have ruled differently, and two jury members did later tell a private investigator that that ballistic test would have had serious impact on their decision.
James Burris, Assistant Special Agent in charge of FBI's Minneapolis Division, your response.
Well, that's an awful lot of stuff to go through. First of all, let's start with the reign of terror. The Wounded Knee situation was 2 years removed from the murder of the agents. The FBI, in its jurisdiction, has always been responsible for prosecuting cases, for gathering evidence, and for addressing crimes on the reservation. Just because Wounded Knee was taken over doesn't change our jurisdiction and our need to go down and investigate cases. You know, the allegation about 64 murders that just came from the defense attorney, we have addressed those. We finally, after years of begging, got a list. You know, who are you talking about? Who are those 64 people that were killed? The 64 people that were killed, one of them, the names that were given to us, was an 18-month-old infant. The allegation was Michelle Tobacco was an 18-month-old infant The defense says she was an Ames supporter murdered without any type of investigation at all, and it's just not true. She died; the infant died as a result of her mom falling on her. I mean, these are the type of fabrications that continue to come up. And if you'd like, I'd be happy to send you a copy of a booklet that we recently did, investigating every one of the murders. There were 57 names that were ultimately given to us. We conducted a thorough review of all of our files, and we published a booklet that shows that, we already know about the murders that are not solved on the reservation, and we continue to work on those every day, including today. The second thing I'd like to say is, you know, the defense attorney argues that there were massive numbers of FBI agents that poured onto the reservation after Wounded Knee. And that's just not true. At the most, we had 12 agents on the reservation at the time the agents were killed. I don't think 12 is a massive number to cover a huge section of South Dakota where we have jurisdiction, where Congress has given us jurisdiction. I mean, we can't walk away just because Wounded Knee happened. We still have to do our jobs. The people of Pine Ridge expect that. The FBI and the link to, from the between the FBI and the goons is simply a fabrication that's convenient for the defense attorneys to bring up. There's absolutely no evidence that the FBI gathers its information from so many different sources, and we don't turn people away because they sound unreasonable. Or what we do is we take the information and we evaluate it as best we can, and we try to corroborate it. We work with anybody and everybody that's willing to work with us in terms of coming in, giving us information.
James Burris, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, I want you to address the issue of the bullet casing and the test done on that. And we're also going to hear from Leonard Peltier's other attorney, Bruce Ellison. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Our guests, John Sennett and James Burris of the FBI, and Jennifer Harbury and Bruce Ellison, the attorneys for Leonard Peltier. President Clinton is now weighing executive clemency for the Native American activists. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with this debate on the case of Leonard Peltier, on June 26, 1975, two FBI agents, Jack Kohler and Ron Williams, entered the Jumping Bull Ranch in South Dakota. The FBI says they were seeking to arrest a young Native American man believed, they said, to be seen riding a red pickup truck. A large number of Ames supporters were camping on the property at the time. The more than 30 men, women, and children on the property were surrounded by FBI agents, SWAT team members, BIA police, local posse members, barely escaped through a hail of bullets. When the gunfight ended, a Native American named Joe Stuntz lay dead. His killing was never investigated, although the FBI will ask if they did investigate that case. The two FBI agents, Kohler and Williams, were also dead, wounded in a gunfight, and then shot point blank through the head. It was Leonard Peltier who was ultimately convicted of their killing. And today we are weighing his case. Our guests again, James Burris and John Sennett of the FBI. James Burris, Assistant Special Agent in charge of the FBI's Minneapolis Division. They investigated the case. John Sennett, President of the FBI Agents Association. Jennifer Harbury and Bruce Ellison are the attorneys for Leonard Peltier. James Burris, you were going through the case. Your comment on the ballistics test. Jennifer Harbury just said that a test was actually done, could not trace it to Leonard Peltier's gun, could not prove it came from his gun. Your response to that?
Yeah, first of all, I think you've got the facts of the case completely wrong. There was no surrounded by FBI SWAT team. These two guys were on their own investigating a case up near Oglala and ran. It was a bad case of circumstances. They didn't even know Leonard was on the ranch. They ran into the Leonard, who was wanted for the murder of a Milwaukee, attempted murder of a Milwaukee police officer. They ran into this guy, and I mean, really, there were just two of them. I mean, it's not a whole form of SWAT team and a shootout. Let's talk about the bullet casing for a minute. First of all, when Leonard executed, or when Leonard and the people that were down there with him executed these agents, one of the shell casings from Leonard's weapon ejected from his weapon and ended up in the wheel well of Jack Kohler's car. That shell casing was later found, and tests were done. There's several types of tests that you can do to shell casings. The first is a firing pin test. It's one of many that you can do. The second, when the bullet is pushed into the weapon, there is a rod that pushes it in, and then when it's fired, there's a rod that extracts it. So there is a second mark on the bullet. It's an extractor mark. The extractor mark was tested in the weapon that Leonard Peltier carried, and it matched. I mean, the Eighth Circuit has said conclusively, when all is said and done, that bullet matched that weapon, and that weapon was put in Leonard Peltier's hands by witnesses at a trial. That's pure and simple why the jury believed it, why they found it credible, and why every court that has ever looked at this has shown that. The defense attorneys can argue all day long about this or that. It's all been argued before appeals courts, and it's all been confirmed that Leonard is the man.
Bruce Ellison, Leonard Peltier attorney.
Well, one of the things about the suppressed ballistics evidence was the Court of Appeals concluded that it cast a strong doubt on the government's case, and the standard by the Supreme Court was that if it casts a doubt, you get a new trial. So right away we knew that something was wrong when Leonard Peltier did not get a new trial. Amnesty International has called since 1981 for an independent inquiry as to how the criminal justice system has been utilized for political purposes by the FBI, citing the Peltier case as an example. And just to touch on a couple of points of Agent Burris, to say that people were not surrounded is just simply not true. By the time that people ran up from the camp, they were receiving automatic and semi-automatic weapons fire from all directions. And this came from kids. It came from other people who were there that day. Agent Burris forgot to mention that although Leonard Peltier was wanted at that time for attempted murder of a police officer in Milwaukee, he was found not guilty when the jury got to hear all the evidence, including from the officer's ex-girlfriend, who testified that when her boyfriend came home that night, he was waving a picture of Leonard Peltier and talking about how he was helping the FBI catch a big one. In terms of the reign of terror, I'd like to just give one example. There was a young A member by the name of Byron DeSursa. After Dick Wilson lost the election, Dick Wilson was the tribal chairman and the head of the goon squad. Byron DeSursa was traveling with three friends towards the community of Wombly when our caravan of goon squad members passed them. They opened up on Byron DeSursa's vehicle, wounding him so badly that he bled to death, although he was a quarter of a mile away from an aid station. The FBI, and this was a case I investigated, the FBI, we turned over witnesses to them. They gave a deal to one of the assassins, and the deal was that this man would receive a 5-year sentence if he testified that the Dick Wilson's son and another goon squad leader acted in self-defense when they fired on a car of unarmed people. So this is the kind of way that the government investigated. I remember that reign of terror. I remember the fear on children's eyes and mothers' eyes and elders' eyes, and how they would go to sleep at night not knowing whether bullet fire would go through their walls of their homes on any given evening. People were afraid to walk outside their homes. The death rate that was on Pine Ridge, the white paper that Agent Burris talks about, we've always appreciated how 25 years after these homicides, the FBI was so willing to investigate this particular matter. It was a terrifying situation if you were a traditional person. I took the place of an attorney, Roger Finzel, who was stopped at gunpoint and nearly killed by the goon squad. The government's response was to prosecute the goons for misdemeanors and do everything that they could to make sure that they got off. We're talking about a situation that needs to be seriously investigated. And I would encourage Agent Burris that if he believes that we have no evidence, to join us in our call for a congressional investigation, as Amnesty International has called for, as the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights has called for.
Bruce, there's just nothing to back
James
that
Burris.
Up. I mean, what you're saying, what you're asking us to do is to investigate cases that we've already investigated. The FBI doesn't make deals. The deals are done by the U.S. Attorney's Office and approved by a judge. So, you know, saying that we did this and we did that, I mean, there's a whole system in place to ensure that justice is done, including the appointment of independent people, judges, to review this entire matter. So I'm just not willing to do that at this point.
I think independent inquiry would be actually wonderfully called for. We'd like a congressional committee with subpoena power, and then we could see. We have a lot of documentation. We have the documentation that shows clearly that once this firefight happened, the criminal investigation was placed under the command of Richard Held, who was the head of the domestic security section of the FBI. Now, how can you say that this is not a political case when such matters happen? Many of the documents that we've gotten under the Freedom of Information Act have large black deletions on them with national security exemptions. This is a highly political case, and it is something that needs to be seriously investigated because the FBI was complicit in suppressing dissent in this country using what can only be considered to be terrorism.
Well,
I would like to bring Leonard Peltier into the conversation. I can't, though, as he's at Leavenworth Prison. He was in lockdown all weekend along with the rest of the prisoners there. But maybe I could play just a clip of what he had to say in an interview we did with him a couple of months ago.
My name is Leonard Peltier. I'm a Lakota and Chippewa Native American. I am currently serving two life sentences for the deaths of two FBI agents.
Did you kill the FBI agents?
No, I did not.
That was Leonard Peltier a few months ago denying that he killed the two FBI agents. John Sennett, president of the FBI Agents Association, is it fair to say this is one of the or the most important case for the FBI right now as you mobilize for your rally, for as the FBI agents mobilize for the rally on Friday?
Well, it is in the sense that we do, in fact, take this personally. There are a lot of people in federal penitentiaries who have and are, will continue to apply for presidential clemency, and the FBI doesn't respond to that one way or another. The Agents Association, of which I'm president, doesn't react to that one way or another. This is different. We do take this personally, and for all of the reasons that Mr. Burris just went through. One of the things is, as I've been listening to Ms. Harberry and Mr. Ellison talk, it's apparent that they cannot separate the few seconds, few minutes in which the killings of Agents Kohler and Williams took place from the larger historical context that they feel is integral to the whole situation. And we reject that altogether. Leonard Peltier is in prison because of bullets that he fired into the heads of two FBI agents within a matter of seconds. It's got nothing to do with political or other forms of repression that they allege to have occurred over decades. And some of the Peltier supporters will even take this discussion all the way back to Christopher Columbus as the person who initiated a reign of terror that continues to this day. And that's just absurd from our point of view.
Jennifer Harbury.
I think the bottom line, as I've said, is that even the United States attorney now admits over and over again in different transcripts at different hearings that no one knows who fired those shots into the heads of the FBI agents. So I think we really need to stick to that position here as the bright line. In addition, I would just like to make very clear that in the 25 years that Mr. Peltier has been behind bars, he's been receiving awards for his human rights work. This man sponsors Native American scholarship programs. He's donated his artwork to contribute to substance abuse programs and to battered women centers. He's adopted children in Central America. He serves on advisory boards to different humanitarian and charitable organizations. He's done remarkable work and has been recognized anywhere.
What about the issue of parole?
He's way overdue for parole. He should have been paroled years ago. In addition, he's done all of this remarkable work, which should have made him more than eligible.
What do you mean he should have been paroled years ago?
If he was any other prisoner, he served more than the normal amount of years necessary to be released on parole, especially given his remarkable good deeds and his failing health. He is not, I was at the last hearing last June of this year, and despite all of this incredible evidence that was presented on his behalf, and despite the fact that he's way overdue time-wise for parole, even under Justice Department standards and guidelines, he was denied on the grounds that, quote, he won't accept responsibility for the crime he's committed. In short, unless he admits to killing the agents, he will not be allowed to be released on parole. In short, if he doesn't admit to a crime he did not commit, he cannot walk free and he'll die in prison.
James Burris, your comment about the prosecutors making the statement that, in fact, they could not prove that it in appeals cases, they could not prove that it was Leonard Peltier who pulled the trigger in the point blank range executions of these two FBI agents.
Both of the attorneys know that the standard here, you don't, if you got a guy who's driving a car and two other guys go into the bank and rob the bank and come back out and they kill a guard as a result, all three of them under our system are liable, just as all three of them are equally liable for the crime. The government doesn't have to prove the elements of that particular crime in order to show that this crime, number one, this crime occurred. Number two, we can't tell because we don't have videotape. We don't have something that definitively shows Leonard Peltier was the one, bam, bam, that did these two guys. Although there's plenty of evidence for the jury to have come to that conclusion. There's plenty of evidence. Leonard's weapon was more than likely the one used. When you shoot somebody at point-blank range, the shell disintegrates pretty quick, the actual bullet fragments. But what they can do is say this type of weapon was used, and that type of weapon was the only one down around the agents. Moreover, the shell casing that flipped into the back of the trunk was from Leonard's gun. Now, do we have videotape that shows him shooting the agents? No. Do we know he was down there? Yes. Can we put him down there? Yes. And by the legal standards that we have, that's beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's why Leonard was convicted.
Bruce
and every
Ellison.
Court has agreed with us.
Well, every court has agreed, but that's been part of the problem, and that's why proceedings were fundamentally flawed and why clemency is so appropriate here. We've already dealt with the ballistics evidence. Firing pin tests, which the FBI suppressed, conclusively showed that that weapon didn't fire that casing. But when we talk about an aiding and abetting theory, we talk about being involved in the firefight, the two co-defendants were found not guilty on self-defense grounds. The difference was the jury in that case was able to hear about the climate of fear and terror on the reservation and concluded that the FBI played a major role in that and therefore concluded that when people were responding to gunfire that they were arguably acting in self-defense. The jury foreman in that case said had Leonard Peltier not been extradited in Canada and had been tried with Butler and Robidoux, he too would have been found not guilty. And so really what we're talking about is a man's inability to defend against a charge of aiding and abetting because the government was able to secure a different judge who changed all the rulings and kept all this evidence out.
We have to wrap up this discussion today, but I wanted to invite everyone back tomorrow for one more segment. One of the issues we didn't address, Jennifer Harbury, you filed ethics claims against the FBI.
A number of FBI officials. Yes, we filed that last June.
And we haven't gotten to that. I didn't want to rush through this debate. And so I wanted to ask everyone, we'll deal with this after the program, if you can join us again tomorrow. This is a very important case. Again, a major rally in New York yesterday outside of the United Nations. More than 2,000 people attended. The FBI Agents Association planning a rally in front of the White House on Friday. If people want to get contact information on both sides to get more information as they tell people about the continuation of the discussion tomorrow, where can they go? Let's start with John Sennett, president of the FBI Agents Association.
Well, there's one of our retired FBI agents on his own initiative has put up a website, Jim, do you know the name of this website?
No, it's noparolepeltier.com, I think.
Noparolepeltier.com, that's correct.
And the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee?
The main number for the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee is 785-842-5774.
And the website?
I believe it's www.freepeltier.com.
.com or org?
.org.
.org. It is that brings us to the end of the program. Jennifer Harbury and Bruce Ellison, attorneys for Leonard Peltier, James Burris, and John Sennett with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's show, call 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion, Terry Allen, and Chris Abrams. Matthew Finch, our engineer, Errol Maitland, our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.